Hello and welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I talk about getting out of your own way. We discuss why and how we humans defeat ourselves. We'll talk about cognitive biases, self-defeating narratives, self-compassion, accountability partners, goals, values, and much more. A couple of announcements before we get into the episode. If you're looking for good professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, you can check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support our show, you can do so by leaving us a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, you can like the video, maybe leave a comment below, and please share the episode with somebody you know who tends to defeat themselves. I bet it'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who doesn't fit into that category. Without further ado, here's today's episode. So, Reed, we've been at this mental health thing for a long time. And a lot of the people that come to us, they'll describe their problems in a variety of ways. But one description that I hear often is, I'm getting in my own way. You know, I sabotage myself. I want to accomplish X, Y, or Z, or I want to change in a certain way. But I keep stumbling over my own self-defeating tendencies.
Sounds like every human.
Yeah, I think we can all relate. I can certainly relate to that one when my clients come to me for help with that particular issue. Yeah. So we thought it might be interesting just to chat for a while on how it is that human beings tend to get in there in our own way and what we can do to stop that nonsense.
Oh, so many ways. But you're right, it does get at the heart of what we do. Yeah. What we try to do to help people is really just helping them clear the obstacles to where they want to be in life. Mm-hmm. Identify and remove the obstacles to their joy, fulfillment, self-actualization, if you will.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point, because when we say I'm getting in my own way of what?
Yeah.
Right? What am I actually trying to get to? What am I trying to build or grow into or accomplish? And the goal itself might be a little toxic or not conducive to mental health.
Yeah, no, this is an interesting thought thread to follow for a moment, because I think about that, including recently. I've been thinking more the past couple of days, knowing we were going to chat about how we get in our own way, thinking about how powerful is tuning into your dharma, your life's purpose, your reason for existing. How powerful is that in plowing through some of these obstacles?
Yeah.
To contemplate, and what place do you need to be in to really embody that?
We've touched on that topic, I think, a lot throughout the long course of this show. You know, getting clarity on one's values or life purpose or meaning, right? We talked a lot about a person's search for meaning and adult development, things like that. So it does make sense that, you know, what, before you say I'm in my own way, it might be nice to know which way are you going,
and
is it really healthy or conducive to the things you just listed, like joy and fulfillment?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, because, well, I like the framework of parts work for looking at this stuff too. Because when you're thinking about that question, or what is the best thing for you in this moment, to continue in this pattern of avoidance that's not serving the greater purpose, or to, you know, face some discomfort, get to the other side of that, and keep moving in the direction of your hopes and dreams, things like that. And you do have to know if you're in your capital S self, right? Or have, as Dick Schwartz would say, have some self energy on board to be able to really contemplate that, to be in that powerful place, to be able to overcome some of those obstacles, those patterns.
Yeah. And for your stereotypical overthinker, knowing whether or not you've got self energy at the helm can be a bit of a puzzle, right? Yeah. How do I know if I'm really being led by my capital S self or core self.
And for the overthinkers, and I find this quite useful, in fact, IFS, Internal Family Systems, does have this cheat sheet for identifying how much self energy you have on board. It's the 8 C's and the 5 P's. Mm. But like, and I use this a lot with myself and clients is before venturing into a territory that requires that self energy, how much compassion do you have on board? How much creativity is there? How curious are you? How connected do you feel to the person or the problem at hand or yourself? Courage, calm, clarity, confidence. Mm. And then the 5 P's I think are fun to layer on. How much presence do you have right now? How much playfulness to be able to get creative with the path forward? Many paths up the mountain. Persistence, perspective, and patience. Like, are you patient enough to sit with this question or to sit in this uncomfortable moment?
And would you say it's not necessary for us to have all of those qualities in equal measures on board to know that we've got self-energy on board?
Yeah, I have this, I view it exactly the same way, and that you might have 0% of your courage on board at the time, but if you're feeling compassionate and calm and curious, mm-hmm. you know, I think you can pull those other levers as you go. Mm-hmm. And no one, like realistically speaking, is in 100% self energy all the time. You know,
it reminds me of that quote that I think I first heard you say. And so if that's true, you might remind me who to attribute it to, but don't confuse symmetry with balance or balance with symmetry.
Oh yeah. That's Tom Robbins.
Tom Robbins. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's symmetry isn't balance. It doesn't have to be all the same in order to be in balance.
Yeah. Right? Tom Robbins, I believe in that same book, Still Life with Woodpecker, he says a quote that's really apropos to this episode. He says, we are our own dragons as well as our own heroes, and we have to rescue ourselves from ourselves.
Mm, there you go. That is apropos.
Yeah. Yeah. Because sometimes you do have to save yourself from yourself, probably more often than we realize.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are the ways in which we are our own dragons?
Oh, one thing that I think is important to point out, it may not apply to all of the ways we get in our own way, but a lot of them stem from this, what you might call a trance of unworthiness that we find ourselves in. Like feeling undeserving, doing things to make ourselves feel small, closing off to life instead of opening up to the entire spectrum of fullness and abundance that and potential that is possible.
I think that's a big one. This trance, as where do we get trance of unworthiness from? Is that a Ram Dass thing?
Also, I've heard it from Tara Brach.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know who else.
But I mean, I think a lot of us can relate to that feeling. We have sort of self-limiting beliefs.
Oh yeah.
Perhaps based in, the ways we were treated, the messages that we got when we were young, either from parents or from society or from just rough experiences, mm-hmm. where we develop what Gay Hendricks calls in his book, The Big Leap, an upper limit problem.
Yeah.
And it could be conscious. It often is subconscious or unconscious, mm-hmm. where, you know, you see this in people who, they're trying really, really hard to achieve a certain kind of success. And then they find themselves getting in their own way, like procrastinating or oversleeping or whatever, as they're approaching that success. And if you were to ask them, like, do you want this successful outcome? Of course I do. It's what I'm working really, really hard to. But they notice this pattern where when they get close to it, they do something to stumble, like to cause a stumble in their own lives.
Yeah.
And so it's this subconscious upper limit problem. It could be based on one of these beliefs, right? That I'm unworthy of a certain kind of success.
Yeah. And I think, a better way to even boil it down might be to look at those self-limiting beliefs and ways we self-sabotage as ways we protect ourselves from potential pain and suffering, including shame, you know, including that painful sense of unworthiness that comes from like failing to achieve something exactly as expected or hoped for.
Yeah, it also is called the status quo bias, or the familiarity heuristic or whatever, where the devil that you know is better than the devil that you don't. So even if what you're used to is a certain degree of misery, it is what you're used to. So people can be afraid of joy. Like they can be afraid of play. They can be afraid of freedom and peace because they just haven't spent a lot of time there. And, or they have some kind of association with openness and peace that, that causes a fight or flight response. And so they would quote unquote prefer to stay in their misery because it's just where they've lived. It's what's familiar to them.
And on the topic of those self-limiting beliefs, and you mentioned that some of them are subconscious, right? And I was actually looking at this in myself today because I'm curious of how many of these ways that I get my own way are, what I say, conscious versus subconscious, unconscious. But it was more fluid than I realized. And I think a lot of this work is shining a light in the shadow parts of ourselves. And it's not that hard in the spirit of awareness to tune into them, like to listen to that incessant dialogue of the inner critic that's holding us back. So anyway, just to circle back to that, I think it's kind of this fluid semi-conscious state that a lot of this resides in, and we can make it conscious or not.
I want to make sure I understand, Reed, because I think you mentioned it not being hard. And I don't know, that that's my experience of it. Because I think sometimes if it's been the dominant voice, if we sort of echo back to the parts idea, if you, if you're blended with a particular part that's really negative or has self-limiting beliefs, it might be hard to know. Like it might be hard to draw that into the light of awareness for a lot of us.
I'm glad you pointed that out because, I'm realizing that my words didn't really capture it well of like,
but, I mean,
it's not hard to find examples of our self-limiting beliefs if we go looking, because they are widespread and pervasive in most of us. And it's, this is almost some of the hardest life's work we're talking about. Like, I think this gets to the root of why we suffer, why we stay stuck, why there's ever a mismatch between our values, hopes, and dreams, and our actual behavior, which is a daily struggle for every human I know.
So maybe one way of restating what you said, just to make sure I've got it accurately, is if you do the work of trying to look into those dark corners, then you'll find that something is there, right? It, it might be very difficult work, but once you start looking, they'll stand out. Like those self-limiting beliefs might stand out.
Yeah. And it seems to me that there's almost a frequency you can tune into. We all have these like, zillions of thoughts going on, and we only are attending to or conscious of a subset, a small, 10 or 20%. I've heard some estimates, and, but we can shift our attention to different things. And I think, I don't know. You tell me, if you were to try and catch some self-critic at work in yourself, would it take you very many minutes of listening or very many hours in a day of trying to pay attention to find something?
It wouldn't now, but I think, and I can't recall with perfect accuracy what I was like when I was 20. I'm a very different
Our
person
bias
now.
Sees as humans. And
but I do remember being convinced of a few self-limiting beliefs that I am not convinced of now. Right now I actually see them as a result of a lot of work that
it's
I've
true.
Done.
True. It's a good point.
You know, this tendency to be very self-critical, for example, like I don't even know where it came from, frankly, because my parents were never very critical of me. It's like I learned it because my parents were super critical. It's almost as if I came into this world with like an ancestral burden of self-criticism. Like who knows where it came from. But yeah, at the time, you know, people would pay me compliments, and my initial visceral reaction was to downplay those compliments, like shed them, push them away. And now I love a good compliment and I say, thank you. That means a lot to me. And if there's any echo of that old voice of like, nah, they don't really know the real you, I see it as a self-limiting belief.
But 20 years ago, you might have not been able to receive it at all and not believed them.
Right.
Yeah.
And even if somebody would have said, and my therapists did back then, that's a self-limiting belief. It's the problem. It wouldn't really stand up in court. If you were to look at the evidence, it'd be like, meh, I don't know if I believe you, you know?
Yeah. And It's a good point, and that's why some people would call them core unconscious beliefs. Right. And I do think a lot of this stuff either comes from that like early childhood environment or beyond. Like mm-hmm. you're talking about the ancestral burdens that you could also look at as your DNA or mm-hmm. your inherited risk for certain predispositions. And there are, I think you were talking about some of this earlier before we even recorded, some of the genetic predispositions for getting tripped up mm-hmm. by yourself, right?
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the field of epigenetics. I mean, you would understand it more than I do as a genetics guy, but this idea that like even a couple generations back, a particular environmental stressor changed gene expression and that gets passed down to your offspring, even a couple generations down. And so that could have resulted in the development of a brain in my skull that was particularly sensitive to certain kinds of, you know, threats or mm-hmm. criticism or whatever.
Yeah, it's true. And you combine that with the random DNA that you inherit.
The roll of the dice. Yeah.
Yeah, the roll of the dice that might give you some of these traits that can be very useful for survival and thriving, or you can get tripped up on too, like, you know, the pursuit of excellence. Mm-hmm.
That's another vein I wanted to make sure we mine is the idea that there are certain traits that we have in modern life that result in self-defeating behaviors, getting in our own way, that might have evolutionary roots.
Like perfectionism.
Yeah, or just like negativity bias, for example. Yeah. Like when we were hunter-gatherers, it might have been really important for us to have a bias toward what could harm us. Yeah. And for that to be the most salient thing in our sensory field, because we needed it in order to survive in a hostile landscape. But arguably for most of us in the modern world, there aren't as many sources of serious mortal peril or danger, but we still have that software, right? That sort of ancient software that is biased toward negative, you know, threats in our environment.
Yeah, you see this machinery at work in PTSD, for example, or I think you even mentioned trauma of the past or early childhood trauma, stress, or other wounds of any kind, I would argue, can certainly shape or plant seeds of these core unconscious beliefs. And it's interesting to see, like, after a traumatic event, that machinery that is there for our protection and survival, like a fight or flight response, can just stay on board longer than it needs to, or get tripped up, triggered when it doesn't need to be. Yeah.
And I kind of like referring to it like you are, as machinery. I'm in the middle of this book, The History of Intelligence, I think I told you.
Oh, yeah, I put it in my Audible queue.
So he's going through just all the way from protozoa to human beings and brains, but he talks about Pavlov in there. And it was just fun to revisit sort of the history of Pavlovian, the discovery of this biologist, not even a psychologist, that discovered how certain unconditioned responses, natural responses, like a dog salivating when you stick food in its mouth, can be triggered if it's paired with what would become an unconditioned stimulus. In the case of the dogs, it was a bell or a buzzer or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you apply that to PTSD and somebody who is in, you know, the battlefield, and there's a loud noise that would definitely represent mortal danger, an explosion or something like that. Now they're at home at Walmart and somebody drops a pallet and they hit the ground. And so they have this overreaction to a stimulus that was similar to the explosion. But now they're on alert, they're hypervigilant. So you've got sort of the machinery of the mind trying to protect the body, now resulting in a self-defeating pattern of hypervigilance and exaggerated startle response.
Yeah, that's a clear-cut example of the machinery at work in that case in overdrive. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think a lot of the ways we get in our own way, like we've started to touch on, can be quite subtle. And like you're helping me remember and articulate better, just they're not always that easy to pinpoint. Mm-hmm. We might be, like you pointed out, merged with that protective part and really seeing the world as it. And understandably, protecting ourselves from the potential pain, past pain that we believe is probably more likely than it actually is. So we push the things away that we really would want, or our higher self would want.
So calling it a protective part, that is one of the things I've really loved about IFS. Like you started talking about IFS and parts and things like that, that can invite compassion into this whole process. Mm-hmm. You know, when I have clients talking to me about their frustration with these self-defeating tendencies, like I feel like I'm out of control. I can't help but binge eat. I can't help but return to this drug or to return to these toxic relationships, even though, you know, if you were to interrogate me, I'd say I don't want them, but I find myself returning to them. So yeah. Thinking of that behavior as a form of self-protection, even if what you're trying to protect yourself from is the unknown, fear of rejection, of failure, this part of you wants to protect you. As angry as you are at it, it wants to protect you. That's one way to sort of wedge compassion into the equation.
Yeah. I love that. And it's, I think it's so important especially as a big picture framework of how to approach this, because you could get extremely frustrated by all the ways you get in your own way, mm-hmm. or you could see those protective parts as, oh, those were quite useful at the time I needed them. And, you know, have this loving, open dialogue with your fears of, and now we have the resources to do it differently, or checking some of our assumptions against the more recent feedback and signs of maybe, you know, positive potential in the world. Really asking ourselves, what am I afraid of and why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think we can overstate the importance of that, of injecting compassion in that way.
Loving these protective parts and voices into the light rather than like chasing them away in the dark with a broomstick and they're just going to hide and get louder.
Yeah. Or wanting them to just totally be excised or demolished or terminated. And, you know, you get that a lot, frankly, in psychedelics, people who are interested in the promise of psychedelic assisted therapy, you know, they come in and, all right, will ketamine, will it make me stop wanting to go to the pantry and feed myself till I'm sick when I'm stressed? Cause I just don't want that anymore. I don't want that part of me anymore. And so we have to work with that, right? Because that's not necessarily what psychedelics do. I mean, they might act on the level of the brain, change some neurotransmitters so that you're a little less prone to that kind of indulgence. But, I think that the more holistic path, the healthier path is the path that you're talking about, is loving them into the light of awareness. And then again, not that we're trying to shill IFS too much, but from the IFS perspective, create a more integrated whole that's led by your highest self, not because you've eliminated the entire boardroom and it's just capital S self at the helm.
I was listening to this Ram Dass talk the other day where he was talking to this crowd well into his illustrious career as a, you know, first a psychologist and then, you know, going to India and coming back a nobody, or Ram being reborn as a speaker and teacher. But he was saying like every one of his neuroses, and he knew these well as a psychologist, every one of them that he had, you know, 20, 30 years ago, he still has. Mm-hmm. And the difference is that he's just learned to peacefully coexist. He invites them for tea, as he puts it. Yeah.
Tea with Mara. Is that kind of the... the concept? I might be blending things here.
But. Yeah. Yeah. So, invite your neuroses for tea and, is a better strategy than like getting out your shotgun and chasing them.
Yeah. It makes me think of the self-discipline world, conquering yourself. And there are helpful tools to be gained from that world.
Yeah.
But I don't love, and I used to live in that world as an athlete and when I was in the military, but I've learned not to love that approach anymore. The sort of beat yourself into submission approach to self-discipline and growth.
I used to, when I was a freshman in college and having a kind of my own growth process of what it took to get into a good groove of studying and getting grades and balancing fun and all that. I had this mantra for a while of like pummel procrastination, but it's funny to look at like nowadays I would, you know, I'd see that, that strategy could work for a time. Like you could latch onto something, discipline yourself through it. But, I would also want to be curious of why is the procrastination there, especially, If you can get underneath the hood with that compassionate curiosity, be like, oh, what am I avoiding? Or where does this come from? Or what am I really afraid of?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I used to say things when I was kind of in a similar mode at a similar time in my life. I used to say some pretty harsh things to myself to move past the avoidance. You know, there might've been some expletives involved, but it was something like, you know, as soon as I would have this feeling to take a break or this feeling to put something off, it was like, no, screw you.
Screw you, yeah, Steve.
Screw you, Steve. Like, or you know, yeah. Don't be a wuss. Don't be a pansy. Like, you're stronger than this. You're better than this. And some of you listening might relate and you might've actually gotten some mileage out of that kind of self-talk. I'm not saying it can't be effective at accomplishing a goal, but man, the collateral damage is pretty severe.
Yeah.
Because who are you really yelling at? Like from this IFS perspective, you're yelling at an inner child, probably. You're yelling at like your inner 7-year-old that is afraid of success and just wants to take a break and wants to be loved or whatever it is.
Yeah, there is an energy about these things, not to get too quantum on you here.
Because
I will admit that I cannot quantify and describe these energies or even point to studies, but there's an energy of forward progress in life, of positivity and hope, right? Mm-hmm. Versus there's energy in another direction that is like blocking you from your joy and things like that. And I think the ways we self-criticize or the ways we put ourselves down are really energy in the wrong direction. And I do really believe that if we could explain it with physics, there would probably be something behind the cheering yourself on, just like getting cheered on, that pushes the winds in your sail even more in those good directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed. When in preparing for this episode, I was thinking about my early training by some of the most influential professors I had, who were sort of acolytes of people like Albert Ellis, you know, REBT, and Tim Beck, and like the early cognitive behavioral therapists. And so we talked a lot about cognitive distortions and cognitive biases, the predictable, reliable ways in which human minds are irrational.
There are so many.
There are a lot. I wrote down a few. We've referenced a few already, but one that is probably the most prevalent is the confirmation bias. And that's this tendency to search for or interpret or look for information that confirms beliefs that you already have, right? You're not looking to disprove yourself. It's one of the reasons why the scientific method is so important, right? Disproving a hypothesis and looking at the data, hopefully controlled for bias.
We may have even pointed this out on our depression episode reviewing a bunch of studies, but before you do a study these days, and I think it's really a wise idea, you state your hypothesis beforehand, a priori, as they like to call it in the academic fancy Latin verbiage.
For before experience.
Yeah. Because you can in fact torture data to tell it what you want it to hear if you set out to do so.
Yeah, the whole idea of the null hypothesis and the scientific method was an attempt to not only control for the bias that's inherent in sort of just the chaotic noise of the physical world, but more so the bias that's present in our own minds.
Yeah, and it's the multiple comparison thing if you're into biostats too, of the more comparisons you do or tests you do on something, the higher the threshold for reaching that like true statistical significance.
Yeah. So I think it can help in your quest to get out of your own way to at least be aware of the ways in which your mind becomes biased. So confirmation bias, again, looking at my list here, a couple of popular ones. There's the availability heuristic. This is where we overestimate the importance of information that's just available to us, right? So, you know, if you think about algorithmic based news feeds that feed you more of what you already like, then the availability heuristic is certainly, it's on board, it's present. It's a demon that's trying to deceive you.
We're feeding the beast with more and more data as it gets stronger.
Right. Data on what we like to see. So
you
might think the world is a terrible place. That's your take on the world. It might be. That might be an objective truth, but it's also an empirical question that you can investigate. But if you want to do that, you got to collect all kinds of data, not just the data that is available to you that is being fed to you by an algorithm that already thinks you think the world is a terrible place. So you can see one post after the other that's just mayhem and people being at their worst, but you're not seeing all the evidence of the world being a great place or people being good and charitable and kind.
And all the while keeping in mind how we are quite wired and primed, if you will, to, you know, have one painful experience and really overprotect. And, you know, those are important protectors that we have in our lives. But if one thing can run amok, it's certainly that, like overprotecting at the expense of some of the things we really want in life.
Yeah, that makes me think of another one of these, this sort of that overprotection tendency that you're talking about, the bandwagon effect.
Oh, yeah.
So this idea that people have a tendency to do or believe things because many other people in their circle believe or do those things.
Think.
Yeah. And the reason what you said made me think of that is that sort of clustering in groups that are homogeneous. There we go. That are similar, right? People with similar beliefs, similar backgrounds, who look similar, is pretty typical of human beings, right?
Yeah, it's
we like what's familiar. It keeps makes us feel safe.
Evolutionary biology and how tribes existed, right?
So you can think of how that can result in you getting your own way, getting in your own way, right? You don't see the value of diversity if diversity looks threatening because it comes from somebody who's different or opinions that are different.
Yeah, yeah. These are important. Are there others on the list you want to mention before I get all tangential on us?
Hindsight bias. We see this a lot in people who struggle with depression.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes called the I knew it all along effect. So this is somebody who, and this is combined with some other biases here, but you know, something bad happens and it's like, I knew it. So bad things always happen to me.
Yeah. Yeah. You're looking for evidence to support your self-limiting beliefs, right. Fairly often.
Right.
I like, Byron Katie's The Work, a really practical approach for many things. But I think a lot of this kind of self-deception we're talking about is ripe for it, because she says, ask yourself four questions. Is it true? And then number two is, can I absolutely know it's true?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like if you really make yourself answer that clearly. And then number three, how do you feel or react when you believe that thought? And what would you do without the thought?
I've also heard that fourth question. Sorry to cut you off, but I've heard that fourth question asked as, who would you be?
Yeah, I like that better. And it's essentially, this is her process for turning it around. Turning that false self-limiting belief upside down and forging ahead. Yeah.
I remember when I first was exposed to The Work by Byron Katie, and I thought, you know, it seems she gets a lot of credit for how cool this is, but it sounded a hell of a lot just like regular, what we would normally do in cognitive behavioral therapy, like examine the evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. But, if anyone wants a practical field guide, you can pick up Byron Katie's The Work, or you could pick up a CBT textbook and get it that way. Or listen to this podcast.
Share it with people who need to hear it. Yeah. But I like that. I like that the idea of using a structure like that or a series of questions like that to help break the spell of unworthiness.
Yeah. You got to wake up from this trance somehow. And that's, I think, a key question. What are the ways? What are the ways that work for you? Like to snap out of something.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about it earlier when you were talking about awareness. So the things that help you be more conscious, and less unconscious. We've quoted Carl Jung's saying ad nauseum about this, but it's, I have it on my wall in my office. I like it so much. Unless you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life, and you will call it fate. So the things that bring, to use your phrase, those things into the light of awareness, anything that does that is going to help you. It's going to help you see, oh, maybe I was biased here, or, oh, maybe this pattern is connected to some old trauma that's resulted in a story that I've been telling myself that might not be true, might not be accurate. So I think awareness generating is at least an important step.
Yeah. It's almost a prerequisite and the greatest change agent, but you still have to make the change, mm-hmm. right? Like, and that's what I'm thinking about as you're talking about awareness. Like, say you're struggling with just to use an example of binge eating, like something triggers you, might be a stressor or an emotion. And because of whatever happened in your life, like as when you were a kid, you fell off your bike and your caregivers would say, oh, don't cry. Here's an ice cream cone or whatever. And that's just been reinforced in so many ways. Say you're aware of all this now, and then what? As you're talking about it, I think about like mindfulness as a way to, like, we're taking mindfulness that we talk about a lot and bringing it onto the streets here, mm-hmm. or like practical applications would be to, you know, go about your day with an intention of when that comes, I'm going to notice, I'm going to tune into these feelings, I'm going to notice, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to insert a pause of 5 minutes. Like when I become aware of this early in the cascade, I'm going to insert a pause of 5 minutes before I go from trigger to response. And there's a lot that can be done in that space and time.
Right. Yeah. So when your therapist tells you sit with that, that's what they mean.
Yeah.
Is sit, don't do anything. Like insert the pause, like you're saying.
Sit in the discomfort. Yeah.
And not only just sit with it in the sense like, oh, I'm just going to suffer for no reason. Sit with it with mindful attention. And often baked in mindfulness is non-judgment, right? So mm-hmm. you're just watching, like you're an alien scientist trying to learn what it's like to be human. So, okay. So there was the trigger and I'm sitting with it. I'm closing my eyes here for you, for people not watching on YouTube, because I'm trying to eliminate distraction, right? So I'm feeling this like tingling in my gut. I'm feeling this sort of this energy, this forward motion energy. I want to go to the pantry. This is really uncomfortable. I'm noticing a couple of thoughts that are coming to my mind, like, well, this is stupid, or I really just don't want to feel this way anymore. Or I'm noticing some memories come back from the past, some mm-hmm. emotions like sadness or anxiety. So,
and you normally don't want to feel those, right. And you might understandably run from them.
I'm noticing I don't want to feel this. Like, but we say mindfulness a lot. I like that you said, like, bring it to the streets, like the practical yeah. tips. Because a lot of people, this is what mindfulness applied to this particular problem actually looks like. So when your therapist tells you to journal, these are the kinds of things you're writing down, right? Okay, I'm noticing the thought that, not I am angry. I'm noticing the feeling of anger.
That place of non-judgmental awareness, mm-hmm. present moment awareness, and sitting with it, maybe we should clarify, doesn't have to mean non-action, sure. right? You might have a strategy of like a predetermined one when you're sitting there in your higher self driver's seat that says, okay, I'm going to notice these. I'm going to insert that pause, that time. And then I'm going to decide to do this instead.
I'm going to go for a walk.
Yeah. And you might have a list of things. And the biggest caveat is this takes repetition and practice, and there will be many, many failures along the way. There will be days where you forget to do it, mm-hmm. days where you want to do it and you don't. And it's, but we are the sum total of our patterns and habits, and they get shifted one step at a time. Even after the biggest, you know, mystical experience or awakening, you still have to change the pattern. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you brought up patterns and habits and repetition, because I think that's also a way that we get in our own way, assuming we know where we want to go. And maybe we should talk about that here in a second. But if you don't have your habits in place and you have other habits that are self-defeating, you're going to continue to stumble. You're going to continue to get in your own way. And like mm-hmm. you said, habits can take a long time. As they say, old habits die hard. It can take a while to establish a new habit.
Yeah. And like we talked about, I think even last time is, you know, there are a few key ways to change habits. The main ones are like small shifts in your behavior repeated over time. And you might say like a change in environment or like a big awakening, but those still require that first step. Mm-hmm. So that's mindfulness on the streets.
On the streets.
And like many things, like your goals, for example, it might feel like in the short term that there's not much progress, but if you look at it day to day, it might be frustrating. But if you look at it week over week, month over month, year over year, patterns do die more quickly when we have that bird's eye view.
Yeah.
And we can shape ourselves big time.
So that makes me think of perspective. And I've referenced a couple of times, like knowing where you want to go. I think one of the ways we get in our own way is just not having a little bit of clarity over about what we want.
Yeah.
What we want to accomplish, or just what do we want to cultivate? It doesn't have to be achievement focused, but what do we want to like welcome in or invite into our lives?
And do you mean in this like a predetermined way you're going to show up? Like if you're going to say no to things you don't really want to do, even though you're a yes person, and violate your own boundaries and end up doing things you really don't want to be doing over and all. Like, does it include those kind of decisions? Are you talking about like big picture direction of who you want to be?
I think it's both. Yeah. So let's say you've followed Reed's advice and you've been paying attention using mindfulness, and you've noticed that you tend to say yes to things that result in some frustration.
Resentment.
Yeah. You don't want to say yes to those things anymore.
And you're not captaining the ship of your own life, and you end up at a place different from where you would like to be.
Yeah. So that tendency is you're getting in your own way. So then you set a goal or a trajectory or an intention. I want to say no to things that I really don't want to say yes to. If it's not a hell yes, it's a no. So then that becomes a goal that you can work on very practically. So, and it doesn't have to be like, I'm going to say no to everything for a day. I mean, you could try that. It'd be an interesting
exercise.
It's a
fun experiment.
Yeah.
People start to wonder, is Steve okay?
What's going on? Hey, he's such a jerk.
He always says yes
to pickleball. I'm used to him saying yes. No. Yeah. But yeah, so that's sort of more of a specific thing. And then, but it's probably related to something we've talked about a lot on the show, and that's values. Like,
yeah,
who I want to be, as opposed to just what do I want to accomplish and what do I want to do.
Yeah. So that clarity, clarity, direction,
you could say lack of clarity is one of the ways we get in our own way.
Yeah. Yep. And there are infinite ways, like refusing to ask or not asking for help. Not saying no, like we were just talking about, is a big one. I mean, we can relate with that, and not asking for help when it's needed. I think everyone can relate, and culturally we certainly can, of suppressing, distancing from emotions that give you information about how to live your life. But they can be uncomfortable at times, those pesky feelings.
Yeah. Accepting help was one that I've had to work on.
And yeah.
In working on it, I started just accepting help for when it was offered, even if I really didn't want it.
Yeah. That's just the best way to practice.
Just as part of the exercise, right?
Yeah.
Like I'd be doing the dishes and after a family get together and somebody would offer to help. And I would really rather just do them on my own. Like I'm enjoying doing the dishes. So I don't have to talk to everybody or whatever. But I would just say that would mean a lot to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I like that. It brings up an example of seeking discomfort in small ways where you can get some practice and some confidence and some skills. Like, just sit with that. When you first hear it, you may want to smack your therapist upside the head. Right. But if you pick, like we've talked about in other ways, like your window of tolerance and polyvagal theory and all of that, just looking for ways you can practice, leaning into the discomfort in ways you know you're going to be able to do and not fall apart.
Yeah, that seeking discomfort is something I've heard you talk about a lot lately. And I think it is so, all the caveats that we've made when we've talked about before, but I think it is such a powerful tool to get out of our own way. I'm going to keep plugging the title of the podcast here, or the episode, I'm thinking of a client that I had who was really frustrated by his social anxiety. And this was a way he was getting in his own way. He wanted to have these rich social experiences, these relationships, but he was just so nervous.
Yeah.
And so we were coming up with ways to seek discomfort around this particular change. I may have shared this story on the show before, but I invited him after the session to walk to the nearest gas station and ask for a 10% discount on the candy bar that he was going to buy. And he's like, what? They're not, it's a gas station. They're not going to have sales on a Snickers bar. And I'm like, yeah, that's not
the
point.
Did he do it?
He did. And his experience was as predicted. Super nervous, afraid of being looked at as an idiot. He did it. And the clerk just said, oh no, they're not on sale. And he's like, okay. And he paid for it full price. And the feeling afterward of relief and feeling really proud of himself, like that actually wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. And I did it, made the next sort of escalated tiers on that particular exposure hierarchy easier to do because it is more confidence.
It is machinery that's going to respond reflexively in a certain way, like run away at the first sign of discomfort because that's what the machinery's primed to do. Mm-hmm. Or you might practice it up a bit to like be okay with a little discomfort while you insert some conscious awareness into the equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this ancient machinery that prompts us to seek safety and pleasure and avoid pain and unfamiliarity and all those things is responsible in some ways for how we stumble at our own hands.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's just I think it's another way that we get in our own way, right? Like just, we're here, whatever here is in this human form, this amazing, wondrous machinery that can heal and also get stuck in very maladaptive patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other thoughts I had about how to get out of your own way, entertain the possibility that you're wrong about a thing. And this could apply to a lot of different areas. It could be applied to these negative sort of beliefs we were talking about earlier. It could apply to sort of society at large. If you think about the societal pressures to believe certain things and group up in a particular group and fight the other group. I see people online fighting about things that I just seem kind of ridiculous. If we could slow down and, as I said, entertain the possibility you might be wrong about a thing, have some epistemic humility, then we might be able to solve a lot of the problems that we face as a globalized society.
Oh yeah. And, on a more micro scale, to think about what that would do in relationship is huge because like, you know, when you enter in relationship with another human, you quickly create these shared patterns together, whether you're conscious of them or not. And you're bringing all your deepest, most vulnerable wounds and triggers and reactions to all those things to each other. And the biggest way to get tripped up is just get defensive, start the blame game, and get stuck in the need to be right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My wife and I, when we talk about what we think we could attribute our success two as a couple, we've been married for almost 19 years, super happy. A lot of it has to do with what you just said. It's we give each other the benefit of the doubt by default.
Yeah.
And I often, if we have some kind of disagreement, I try to start from that premise. Like I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And I believe it. I've been wrong enough.
That's
I believe it. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
And I should say that if any of you are listening that are in relationships where that doesn't feel possible, there are certain circumstances in which that could feel a lot more threatening if giving them the benefit of the doubt hasn't paid off and they've been deceptive or they've hurt you. I'm lucky in a lot of ways. So I want to make that caveat.
Takes two to tango for sure. And you need, but we also unfold, grow, develop, heal at our own unique individual pace. And that's another challenge in relationship is it's not happening in unison, in sync, in step. We've talked about these unconscious contracts or patterns, if you will. But I think one thing we're talking about to sum it up is that just remember it's the pattern is the enemy, not each other. And you could work on that together.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That takes some awareness, that takes some trust and humility, I think, to arrive at that place. But it's wise. I think that's good advice.
Yeah, because that is a way, a kind of a clear-cut example of the ways humans get in their own way of, you open your heart to another human, and you might feel some of the highest highs. And then, you know, because life is unpredictable, uncertain, and there is a lot of pain, you know, something happens and you feel like the deepest pain you've ever felt too. And it's understandable that you might want to close your heart and protect. And that's what a lot of people do, is push off, avoid, self-sabotage from relationship because of the fear of getting hurt again.
Sure. Would you say that there is ever a case where a person, it has a tendency to open their heart to someone they shouldn't?
Oh yeah. Though? Yeah.
Like, 'cause that could be a way that we get in our own way, is to become overly vulnerable with people who don't deserve our trust or our vulnerability.
I think I saw it on my Spotify this morning, driving in, some song that, I forget who it was, but, it said, "I fall in love too easily," from one of the musicians I follow. But I think, you know, our attachment style, you know, sum total of all our past experiences, it all adds to this of, you know, the, how much are we like aggressively closing off to life versus opening up, but there's also the boundaries, how porous are they? How balanced are our protectors and what they need to do?
Yeah. You see people sort of recapitulating old patterns if they've been relationship patterns. It kind of harkens back to what I said about what's familiar, the devil that you know is better than the devil that you don't. But, you know, if you're used to being in a relationship with a narcissist or with people who, don't take your needs into consideration, then perhaps that's, you know, given your attachment style, that's what you seek. And so you have this tendency to open your heart to the people who make you feel excited, the dangerous ones, and close your heart to the people that actually you could have a relatively safe and loving relationship with.
Yeah.
And I bet some of you listening can relate to that pattern.
Oh yeah. And know that you're all coming with your own childhood wounds and, past experiences that will spill out like you wouldn't believe at the closer and closer you get. And, but you can also upgrade your childhood ways of coping with new ways, especially in that teamwork approach, like you're talking about in your relationship. It's a beautiful thing of just that stance of seeking first to understand, listening, a stance of humility, like I may be wrong. And that goes so far. That's half the battle right there. Because then you can like listen, validate, make sure you got it before you even dream about jumping in and trying to fix something.
Yeah. And I will say, it's easier for me to do that because I know my partner is going to do that in return.
Yeah.
And we do want to be cautious, like I said, about doing that with somebody who's not going to be reciprocal. But sometimes one of the members of the partnership will need to make the first step, like extend the olive branch.
Put your weapons down first.
Yeah. And you can develop into that place where you develop trust on both sides that, okay, that's our thing now. We're giving each other the benefit of the doubt. We're trying to be humble.
Yeah. Relationships are a good example of, it's easy for people to get flustered beyond what they might on a day-to-day basis. Like relationship mirroring can push some of the most tender buttons, and it's easy to get your weapons up. And I think, like if you can view it as a, you know, whoever can notice it first to put their weapons down first, you might just have started this beautiful cascade of reconnecting and avoided yourself hours or days of painful disconnect.
Yeah. And I've noticed that in my own relationships or the couples that I've worked with. When one member of the party, one member of the couple decides to put those weapons down, then it often results in sort of a relaxation of the nervous system in the other person. Like, okay, his weapons are down. Maybe I can put mine down too, or I can lower the walls.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of some other ways that we can help folks get out of their own way. One is accountability. So I think about habit formation, like we were discussing before. It can be helpful to have somebody else on board, and that could be a friend, that could be a therapist, it could be a coach, it could be a mentor, it could be an accountability group of sorts. But just to help, I guess, support lends social scaffolding to this commitment that you've made to yourself to make a healthy change. I've noticed that's been really helpful, yeah. Whether it was, you know, getting in shape and recruiting some buddies. All right, we're going to do these workouts together, or going to great therapists and coaches to help me accomplish yeah. my goals.
It ties into what we were talking about earlier with mindfulness. And I'm convinced that there's nothing as powerful as the presence of a supportive other cheering you on, seeing you, mm-hmm. understanding you, and helping you ride the wave of that discomfort, that pattern into a new place.
Yeah. You know what, Reed? The consistency of this podcast is an example of this. Because when you and I first started this podcast, I remember we had both said, like, we'd always wanted to start a podcast. Like, we were both podcast mm-hmm. fans, always thought it would be cool. I mean,
I made a pattern.
I had thought about it forever. But because we're doing it together,
yep.
we've been accountable to each other.
Yeah.
And Numinous has been great. Novamind before them, sponsoring this podcast. But it's not like anybody's looking over our shoulder. It's like, it's been you and me.
You're my accountability partner.
And likewise.
yeah.
And so I think it's just a fun example of how having an accountability or somebody that sort of you're, you know, arm in arm doing this thing with increases the likelihood that you're going to not get in your own way.
And shout out to Jamie, my little brother, yeah. for his audio wizardry, because it's another way we would have gotten in our own way.
Oh, yes.
Fumbling with that stuff.
No, yeah. We wouldn't have made it without Jamie. Without our Jamie.
We just want him to be like the Jamie on Joe Rogan where he says, Jamie, Google this, and then it magically appears on the screen. We don't have that tech in place yet.
But yeah, we're not that ambitious.
It exists. Yeah, it's that, though. It's the ambition.
That's what it is.
No, it's the values.
Well, my friend, anything else on your mind about getting in our own way or getting out of it?
Well, one... This is semi-related, but I read this quote, and I don't even know who the person is, but it reminds me of how we can help each other with this too. It's by Lloyd Shearer, who says, "Resolve to be tender with the young, compassionate, and the aged, sympathetic with the striving, tolerant with the weak and the wrong. Sometime in your life, you will have been all of these."
Mm.
Compassionate with all the versions of you, and all the versions of others, and know that sometimes people's like annoying behavior is really just a call for love or help.
I like that. That's been a quick path to compassion for me when I'm frustrated with somebody, is to remind myself that I've been there too. You know, somebody cut me off in traffic today. My initial response was anger. And I didn't mm-hmm. have kind thoughts about this person.
Ooh, what and kind of thoughts?
I'm not going to be that vulnerable. But yeah, but I was able to remind myself, like, Steve, you've cut people off before. And I was like, oh, yeah. Okay, well, I don't love that this person cut me off, but I really can't, I can't shame them from a high perch because I've been there.
Yeah, very true. Well, thanks, Steve, for being my accountability partner.
Likewise.
And for having these deep chats.
Yeah, hopefully it was useful to you listeners. Thanks, Reed. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. Like the videos. And share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training.
The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.